Greetings, beloved family. I begin in the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Most Merciful. I bear witness that there is but one God. Welcome to the Black Agenda Conversation here on the Facebook page of the Black Agenda Project. I am Brother David Muhammad, and we're going to share some powerful information with you. Let me just say from the offset, this Saturday, November 27th, we are hosting African Expo number 10 at the Kwame Ture Education and Development Center in Success Lavento. So, of course, November in Trinidad and Tobago is Black History Month, and we are looking forward to hosting with you. We've gotten to number 10, and we're pretty excited about that. All right, so today we'll be looking at the assassination of Malcolm X. And this new 2021 November verdict slash decision that has come forth out of the American courts. And it has been really monumental because for many, many, many years, there has been this perception that has been mischievously promoted that the Nation of Islam were responsible for the assassination of Malcolm X. And there's been so much unbridled propaganda based on hysteria, misinformation, blatant plain lies, but in this particular instance, cover-ups of the real culprits. And this information we have been sharing for many, many years, actually since the 1970s, that the men who were accused of this crime were not involved. The Honorable Minister Louis Farrakhan, for decades, has been calling for the reopening of the FBI files on this matter. And this is a great lesson for all people who are conscious, all Black people, period, in particular those of us who are parts of organizations and movements and social activist groups, those of us in the Third World and Caribbean societies, especially those who have had strong leadership representation, such as Dr. Eric Williams of Trinidad and Tobago, Michael Manley of Jamaica, Errol Barrow of Barbados, and Forbes Burnham of Guyana, as well as Maurice Bishop of Grenada. Those who have been spied on, who have had assassination attempts against their lives, such as Fidel Castro of Cuba, Hugo Chavez of Venezuela, and many others. This lesson on the assassination of Malcolm X and the way we're going to lay it out for you, we pray that you see great value in it because this is a topic that's relevant to all of us. Now, it was reported from around Thursday, November 18th, 2021, in all of the mainstream media that a court decision was taken to exonerate two of the men that were held culpable for the murder of Malcolm X. I'll read straight from the U.S. Guardian newspaper first to give you a direct reference to the story. And please share this on Facebook. I want to thank so much. We just crossed 20,000 followers on Facebook on the Black Agenda Project organization's page. And we appreciate you so much. We ask you to please share this live. So, United States Guardian newspaper, Thursday, November 18th, 2021, headline, two men convicted of killing Malcolm X exonerated half a century later. Muhammad Aziz, now 83 years old, and the late Khalil Islam, both men known as Thomas 15X Johnson and Norman 3X Butler, were convicted in 1966 after a trial in which authorities withheld evidence favorable to the defense, said their attorneys, the Innocence Project, and civil rights lawyer David Shenies. The Manhattan judge, Elad Biben, dismissed the convictions of Aziz and Islam on Thursday afternoon. He said, quote, I regret that this court cannot fully undo the serious miscarriages of injustice in this case and give you back the many years you lost, she said. As the motion to toss out the convictions was granted, the courtroom burst into applause. The recent investigation found information in FBI files that the Nation of Islam has been calling for the reopening of, about witnesses who could not identify Thomas 15X Johnson and Norman 3X Butler, and implicated other suspects, according to the District Attorney Cyrus Vance Jr. The files reveal that the late FBI Director J. Edgar Hoover ordered agents to tell witnesses regarding the Malcolm X assassination not to reveal that they were informants when talking with police and prosecutors. He said, quote, I apologize for what were serious, unacceptable violations of law and the public trust. There is one ultimate conclusion. Mr. Aziz and Mr. Islam were wrongfully convicted of this crime. Again, the Nation of Islam has been saying this since the 1970s. In fact, since the 1960s, it took 2021 for the American courts to come out and say these men were wrongfully convicted of this crime. The co-founder of the Innocence Project, Barry Scheck, also condemned the wrongful conviction, saying the damage done to them and their families is immeasurable. Had exculpatory evidence been made public, it would have changed the history of the civil rights movement in this country, he added. Now, Malcolm X was an icon. He was the national representative of the Honorable Elijah Muhammad. He was a direct student of the Honorable Elijah Muhammad and a spokesman for him. And he had helped build the Nation of Islam and establish different branches of the organization across the United States. Of course, in November 1963, when President John F. Kennedy was assassinated and the Honorable Elijah Muhammad instructed all of his ministers not to make any comments about the assassination, and Malcolm X did speak, he was suspended for 90 days initially, and then, as I'll go over with you, he held two press conferences on March the 8th and the 12th, 1964, explaining that his time was up, but there are agents coming, infiltrating his organization, his circles, as well as the Nation of Islam, and they were responsible for creating a rift. So he's still a follower and believer in the Honorable Elijah Muhammad, but he's going to start working on his own because of the agents. And then later on, of course, with the hard work of those trying to bring about conflict and contention and mischief and division and disunity between the leadership, that he eventually further pulled away. And then it became known that someone was trying to kill him. Now, Malcolm X landed in France in his last days, and he was refused entry into France because it came to Malcolm X's attention that there was an assassination plot against his life in France, and they did not want him killed on French soil. Malcolm X also, in 1964, traveled to Egypt. And in Egypt, he was food poisoned, and he had to go through a very extensive, uncomfortable medical procedure to pump out his entire stomach in order for him to survive. And Malcolm X came to the conclusion and started saying when he returned that he knew that the Nation of Islam did not follow him to France, and that the Nation of Islam did not poison him in Egypt, and that this assassination plot seemed to be coming from so many more angles, some of these which were only discovered several years later. So on February 21st, 1965, Malcolm X was about to address 400 people at the Audubon Ballroom in Manhattan, New York, when there was a disturbance. And everyone, of course, is looking forward, focusing on Malcolm X. Someone in the back shouts out, "Nigga, get your hands out of my pocket." Everyone looks back, is distracted, someone throws a smoke bomb, and while everyone is looking that way, gunmen come down the aisle and carry out the assassination. Now, one man was picked up on the scene. His name was Talmadge Hare. None of the other men were picked up on the scene. And two men, members of the Nation of Islam, were later arrested. Thomas 15x Johnson, Norman 3x Butler. Now, let's look at some facts. Members of Malcolm X's organization later testified that if those men, Butler and Johnson, now Khalil Islam and Aziz, if they were present at the Audubon Ballroom on that day, we would have definitely recognized them because we were all colleagues. But they were not there. The one person that they did arrest on the scene, Talmadge Hare, confessed, "Yes, I did it," he said. He said, "But these other two men here, they're not part of this." And then when they asked him, "Okay, well, if these two other individuals were not part of it, then who were the other assailants with you?" And he never revealed their names until 12 years later in 1977. Some other factors to focus on, though, regarding the assassination of Malcolm X. One, there were a number of other individuals, both inside and outside the venue where Malcolm X was assassinated on the day that were never even discussed. Two, everywhere where Malcolm X spoke, there was a search procedure before he spoke to ensure that no one brought in any weapons. But on that day, the guards at the front door were instructed to not have a search procedure. What are the odds that the one day that they have no search procedure, that these men bring in all these high-powered weapons into the Audubon Ballroom that Malcolm X ended up being shot with 21 times? Who was it who had the influence and authority within Malcolm X's circle to tell the guards at the door, do not have a search procedure today? Also, it was noticed in the accounts of the secretary of Malcolm X and others that when they arrived to the venue, the seating arrangement was different. Instead of a center aisle coming down the middle, there was a bulk of chairs in the center and two side aisles, which the gunmen subsequently used to run down the aisle on either side and shoot Malcolm X 21 times. And then fourth, the Audubon Ballroom, the venue of the assassination, was rented out the night before, February 20th, 1965. But there was no venue, there was no event there. So they say five shooters were involved. But we have to ask, well, who were the people who had influence by the door to stop them from doing the search procedure? Who were the people who had influence over the setting up of the chairs to remove the center aisle and have the two side aisles where the gunmen used? Who were the people who rented out the Audubon Ballroom the night before? And so many of these questions remained unanswered. According to Bruce Perry, 1989, in Malcolm X, The Last Speeches, on February 23rd, James Farmer, the leader of the Congress of Racial Equality, announced at a news conference that it was local drug dealers and not the Nation of Islam who were to blame for the murder of Malcolm X. Others accused the New York Police Department, the FBI, or the CIA, citing the lack of police protection, the ease with which the assassins entered the ballroom, and the failure of the police to preserve the crime scene. Dr. Manning Marable, who has done one of the most comprehensive bodies of research on the assassination of Malcolm X, in A Life of Reinvention, he explores the fact that Malcolm X was not fully aware of the extent of undercover law enforcement that were in his presence on that day. Of course, he would not have known until he actually passed away. In his own autobiography, written by Alex Haley, it says he wasn't fully aware of the degree to which the federal and state law enforcement agencies were surveilling him. Malcolm X did not know the degree to which his organization, as well as the Nation of Islam, had been infiltrated by agents and informants. Dr. Marable's research uncovers the fact that as early as the 1950s, Malcolm X was helping the Honorable Elijah Muhammad establish temples of the Nation of Islam around the country, and Boston was a city he helped set up a meeting place in a private home. Now listen to this. The FBI files noted that Malcolm X, this is January 1954, one full year before the Honorable Minister Louis Farrakhan even joined the Nation of Islam, that Malcolm X had a meeting in a private residence that had between 10 and 12 people in attendance, and among that small group of 10 or 12, one of them in attendance was an FBI informant. Undercover agents and informants also infiltrated Muslim Mosque Incorporated and the Organization of African-American Unity, the two groups that Malcolm X formed after his split with the Nation of Islam. Now, this only gets deeper. And think, the man who gave Malcolm X mouth-to-mouth resuscitation on the ground when he was dying, bleeding from the gunshot wounds, a man named Gene Roberts, was an informant for the FBI. And the funny thing about it is, after Malcolm X was assassinated and Gene Roberts was there trying to give him mouth-to-mouth resuscitation, after the whole Malcolm X saga, he went and joined the Black Panthers. And in the Black Panthers, he continued his role as an informant for the FBI. There's an interview with Gene Roberts on YouTube. You can take a look at it. He's openly testifying everything. Dr. Marable says, Mr. Roberts' first assignment was to infiltrate the Muslim Mosque Incorporated. And in the 1970s, the public finally learned about COINTELPRO, Counterintelligence Program, and other secret FBI programs established to infiltrate and disrupt civil rights organizations during the 1950s and the 1960s. Now, there's a recent film called Judas and the Black Messiah, with two of the stars, or one of the stars from the Black Panther movie. And in it, it looks at the life of Fred Hampton, who was the head of the Black Panthers chapter in the city of Chicago. Fred Hampton was 22 years old. He was executed by the police along with Mark Clark and about 10 others. Now, the film shows you the true story of a man who is a car thief. It starts off looking at this car thief. And this man is stealing a car. He steals another. He's stealing cars. And the police and the FBI, they're watching him. They're not interested in protecting the property like Kyle Rittenhouse. We're going to get to that. Trust me, we're going to get to that. They're letting him steal the cars. And then they catch him and say, well, look, we have evidence of you committing this crime. We have evidence of you committing that crime. We have evidence of you stealing this car. We have evidence of you stealing that car. You are looking at almost a full lifetime in prison. But you don't have to go to prison. You can do something for us, and we will let you off. What do I have to do to avoid going to prison? They say to him, we want you to join the Black Panthers. And we want you to become friends with Fred Hampton. We want you to get close with him and give us information. And it was from the information of that informant planted by the American law enforcement authorities that they got information on where Fred Hampton was the night that they came in and executed him in his bed. Now, it may not have been the specific mission of the informant to assassinate Fred Hampton, but definitely to play a key role. Because sometimes the only way we can fall is when we betray each other. And so these men now, being placed inside organizations, The FBI had so many plants inside the Nation of Islam, inside Muslim Mosque Incorporated, inside the OAAU, inside the Black Panthers. All these black organizations that were spelling liberation for the masses of the people, the FBI felt that they must put their people in there. And how did they get these people? It's not that traitors and stool pigeons and backstabbers voluntarily form a line to sign up to bring their own people down. But they catch you doing crimes, or they even take you out of jail and say, we're giving you an opportunity to start a new life, but we want you to join the Nation of Islam. We want you to join the Black Panthers. We want you to join Kwame Ture's organization. We want you to join the civil rights movement with Dr. Martin Luther King. And this is what we want you to do. This is a consistent history. In Malcolm X, the FBI file by Claiborne Carson, from page 360, the writer reprints a United States document of the justice, a justice document from the FBI dated February 22nd, 1965, the day after Malcolm X was killed, which is a report to the director, reference number 100-399-321, from someone who had agents and or informants in the ballroom when Malcolm X was killed. In the report, clear details are given from the informant, but where the person or person's names are referred to, the phrase bureau deletion appears. Now, if we've had this information for years, that on the night after Malcolm X was killed, an FBI report is given from someone who was inside the ballroom, deleting the actual names, what more evidence do we need? But we're so programmed to want to participate in the bringing down of our own people and all of those mischief-making parrots on social media who, oh, Nation of Islam has something to do with Malcolm X. Oh, Nation of Islam killed Malcolm X. You're like a puppet with the devil's hand up your sister, moving your mouth to say exactly what he would want you to say. In the autobiography of Malcolm X, in the foreword, it also raises many questions about the killing of Malcolm X. It says on page 62, Deputy Police Commissioner Walter Arm's statement that Malcolm X refused police protection conflicts directly with statements of many of his associates that during the week preceding his assassination, Malcolm X complained repeatedly that the police would not take his requests for protection seriously. The suspect that had been arrested by Patrolman Hoy as he was being chased from the meeting on February 21st, 1965, was not publicly identified. Police sources said they had 20 officers stationed at the Audubon Ballroom, but none of them in uniform, as well as agents of the Bureau of Special Services. But these men were nowhere in evidence at the time of the assassination. And incidentally, the one shooter who was held, Talmadge Hayer, was rescued from the crowd and arrested immediately after being picked up by the two patrolmen, Alvin Aronoff and Louis Angelos, in a squad car cruising by outside at the same time that the shooter was running out. So, this shooter, Talmadge Hayer, in 1977 and in 1978, gave testimonies. He submitted two sworn affidavits reasserting his claim that Butler and Johnson, members of the Nation of Islam, were not involved in the assassination. In his affidavits, Hayer finally named four men who were put up to the crime by an unidentifiable chain of command. All of them were installed members of the Nation of Islam's Newark, New Jersey, number 25 mosque, as having participated with him in the job. So here again, the enemy placing his people in strategic places, and we have always been like that for our enemies. Now, think. Let's get into some clearer details. And much of this information has always been presented by the Nation of Islam, by Minister Farrakhan, by various representatives in the Nation of Islam. This whole account is published in Black Studies in extensive detail since 2015. But it was only the recent Netflix series entitled Who Assassinated Malcolm X that inspired the courts now to reconsider their verdict. And see, so many people are looking at Netflix now, in particular with the pandemic and everyone on lockdown and so on. So it's like they're forced to respond. Here, check this. In his affidavits, Talmadge here, the one man who was caught on the scene as an assassin of Malcolm X, named the four men. He said a man later identified as Wilbur McKinley was the one who shouted, "Get your hands out of my pocket," and threw a smoke bomb to create the diversion that had everyone looking that way while the gunmen were running this way. He said another man later identified as William Bradley had a shotgun and was the first to fire on Malcolm X after the diversion. Hare asserted that he and a man later identified as Leon Davis, both armed with pistols, fired on Malcolm X immediately after the shotgun blast. And he also said that a fifth man later identified as Benjamin Thomas was involved in the conspiracy. Hare's statements failed to convince authorities to reopen their investigation of the murder. That was 1977. We published the entire findings from the FBI, from the CIA, from Dr. Manning Marable, from all of the researchers in Black Studies in 2015. But it made it to Netflix. In 2021 now, the court decides to make this decision. But let's go even deeper. Page 32 of the book entitled The Judas Factor by Carl Evans says, quote, "Alarmed by the rapid growth of the sect, the Nation of Islam, the FBI began devising counterintelligence schemes to cut a hole in Elijah Muhammad's fishing net. In mid-January 1953, J. Edgar Hoover, head of the FBI, received word from the FBI's field office in Chicago that Malcolm X was responsible for the rapid growth of the sect. Something had to be done to stop him, the Chicago office suggested, as far back as 1953. A few days later, J. Edgar Hoover requested authorization from the United States Attorney General's office to execute an investigation of Elijah Muhammad, Malcolm X, and other key members of the Nation of Islam. However, J. Edgar Hoover of the FBI felt the Nation of Islam could be prosecuted under the new Smith Act, which was an act of Congress passed during World War II, making it a federal offense to advocate or belong to any group which advocated the violent overthrow of the government. What overthrow of what government? The FBI had already installed electronic bugging devices in the Chicago and Detroit branches of the Nation of Islam, but on February the 9th, 1953, the Justice Department's Criminal Division informed the FBI that evidence was insufficient to establish any violations of the Smith Act, which they thought they could get the Nation of Islam on, but future prosecution under the act may be possible. So they continued to probe and spy on the Honorable Elijah Muhammad. But the FBI's Detroit branch discovered in April 1953 that Malcolm X had failed to register with any of the local war draft boards since his release from prison. Now they're thinking, we need to try to get him back in prison. But before he came into contact with the message of Islam as taught by the Honorable Elijah Muhammad, he was a gambler, he was a gang member, he was a street criminal, he was a shooter, a robber. involved in so many crimes. But now he comes into Islam, joins the nation. He's clean. But they're trying even harder to get him in jail as a black man who has cleaned up his life than they were ever interested in keeping him in jail when he was there. So based on him not registering for the war draft, they visited him at his workplace to intimidate him. And in June 1953, they noted that Malcolm X was promoted to the rank of assistant minister in the Nation of Islam in Detroit. And then he was sent to Boston in 1954 to open up a new mosque. And then they note that there was a new member there named Louis Walcott, who eventually became Louis Farrakhan. But Evans says on page 36 that on June the 8th, 1954, all of this is more than 10 years before Malcolm X was even assassinated, he was placed on the communist sabotage list and the detention of communist list. And individuals on these lists were also in what was called the FBI's Security Index. 3 months later, he was placed on the communist index card. Look at it. A black man who's making an effort to not just clean up himself, but to help his people. Then it says, although the FBI had installed microphones in most of Elijah Muhammad's older buildings, the Nation of Islam was growing too fast for its surveillance methods to keep up, so the FBI decided it was time to develop a high-level informant program in the Nation of Islam. Malcolm X was visited at his New York home by two FBI agents on January the 10th, 1955, and they asked him for a list of all of the locations and branches and officials of all of the Nation of Islam organizations. And the FBI noted in their files, and it's recorded on page 37 of Evans's Judas Factor, quote, since Malcolm X considered them to be devils, he suggested that they go back to hell. And then 1963 came, his suspension from speaking took effect, and of course he was silenced for 90 days. And it was during that 90-day period that the enemy really went to work. Now let's come to the real essence of this. Malcolm X held two press conferences in New York in the month of March 1964 regarding his relationship with his teacher. First one on March the 8th at the Teresa Hotel, Malcolm X said the following, quote, there has been talk of a split between me and the Honorable Elijah Muhammad. After 90 days of complete silence, I want to make my position crystal clear. I am and always will be a Muslim. Internal differences within the Nation of Islam forced me out of it. I did not leave on my own free will. But now that it has happened, I intend to make the most of it. I am going to organize and head a new mosque in New York City. Now, Malcolm X held another press conference 4 days later. And he was concerned about the fact that his mail was being intercepted. There were mischief makers who were reporting false news about him. And that there were those blocking his communication to his leader and teacher. So we held a second press conference on March the 12th, 1964, at the Sheraton Hotel in New York. This time, the purpose of this press conference was to speak directly to the Honorable Elijah Muhammad. And he said, quote, not speaking to the world, speaking directly to Elijah Muhammad in a press conference because of the interception of his communication. He said, despite what has been in the press, I have never spoken one word of criticism to them about your family. You are still my leader and teacher, even though those around you won't let me be one of your followers or helpers. He wrote numerous letters. Many of them he recorded with his own voice. And we have some of those recordings. Literally pleading with his teacher to let him back in the Nation of Islam. And then, of course, in 1964, he went to Mecca in Saudi Arabia and came back and declared in a press conference that when he was out there in Mecca, he saw things that he did not know were the case, and that there were white Muslims as well. Now, when he said that, you know, he always thought from following the Honorable Elijah Muhammad that only black people were Muslims, and that he saw white people and he ate from the same plate and slept on the same mat and so on when he went to Mecca. But now I know my place on this, and I'll just say that people in the Nation of Islam, when they heard that, they were thinking to themselves, but Malcolm X was sent over there to the Middle East and Africa 5 years earlier, since 1959. And Malcolm X would have already met white Muslims. The Honorable Elijah Muhammad sent Malcolm X as an ambassador to the Nation of Islam, to all of those same Muslim countries and African countries that welcomed him again as a guest 5 years later after he was no longer a part of the Nation of Islam. But he already met white Muslims. He already met light-skinned Arab Muslims. He met heads of state and people from all walks of life in the world of Islam. And the Honorable Elijah Muhammad always said, in message to the black man, it's written that Islam is a faith for the black, the brown, the red, the yellow. And that it brings all humanity on the same level. So that was a little bit confusing. And what was also confusing was, on one hand, to say, well, yes, there are white Muslims too, but then still had the Organization of African American Unity, which was dealing with the problem of racism, which is what the Honorable Elijah Muhammad taught him was a major problem of our people. So the time passed by, and of course the rift was intensified. And then the assassination took place. But I want us to put this in context a bit. The Nation of Islam, under the leadership of the Honorable Minister Louis Farrakhan, is in love with Malcolm X. We are in an eternal debt to Malcolm X. Malcolm X helped build our organization. He was a great helper and representative and spokesperson for the Honorable Elijah Muhammad. One of my major pathways into Islam was reading the autobiography of Malcolm X, and in particular chapters 12, 13, and 14, which were talking about the Nation of Islam. But I, in reading the autobiography of Malcolm X, became more interested in his teacher and how magnificent that man was, not just to make Malcolm X who he was, but to make thousands of Malcolm X's, to pick up hundreds of thousands of black people, take them out of prison, take them off the street, take them off drugs, take them off alcohol, bring them together, let them unite and pool their resources, open skills banks and think tanks, and establish true black power through African unity. And I was moved and touched by the autobiography of Malcolm X, but more so by the life of the Honorable Elijah Muhammad, was able to build a black economic empire. Now, when we look back to 1965, Malcolm X died speaking to an audience of 400 people. When you think of, say, Minister Louis Farrakhan today, Minister Farrakhan would speak at a venue like a football stadium with 35,000 people. At Madison Square Garden, he spoke to 40,000 people. At Randall's Island in New York, he spoke to 74,000 people. In Atlanta, at the Atlanta Dome, 60,000 people. At the Men Only meeting in Houston, Texas, 35,000 people. Malcolm X was expanded in his death to a magnitude that he never had during his life, except as a spokesperson for the Honorable Elijah Muhammad. This is not in any way to diminish or take away from the greatness of him. But when you think of Minister Louis Farrakhan being able to call 2 million black men out to the Million Man March, and probably the only black man alive in the Western Hemisphere who could attract as many people to his presence as a World Cup football match, an Olympic 100-meter event, an NBA basketball championship, or a West Indies cricket match when we were in our glory days. Malcolm X never had that kind of impact. But in death, he was over-sensationalized to that degree. So as our brother Khaled used to point out, they put the X everywhere. So there's an X on the hats, X on the t-shirt, X on the bag, X on the sneakers, X on the posters. And all the Malcolm X propaganda, but they don't consult the experts who can explain, who have the experience, who know about the whole X story. But the enemy expanded Malcolm X's magnitude in death to a degree way bigger than it ever was in life, and then used that story to try to connect the Nation of Islam to his demise. And it took up to 2021 for that record to be set straight. When we go back to the FBI files, the specific reasons for many deleted passages are indicated by references to subsection of Title 5, United States Code Section 552. It's also interesting to note that a Malcolm X movie was being made as early as 1970 by a great black man in the media named Louis Lomax. Louis Lomax did a lot of investigation about the assassination of Malcolm X in a similar way that the brother, I think it's Abdurrahman Muhammad, did with the Netflix series from 2018. Louis Lomax in 1958 became the first ever black television journalist in the United States on a major level and was a highly respected professional in the black community in the field of journalism. His colleague was Mike Wallace. In 1959, Louis Lomax told Mike Wallace about this organization called the Nation of Islam. And he suggested to him, well, maybe you should do a special on this Nation of Islam. And then Mike Wallace did so on CBS. And they did this documentary in 1959, which aired on July 13th. That was the first time the majority of white America saw anything or heard anything about the Nation of Islam. And the name of the documentary was The Hate That Hate Produced. Who were they talking about? An organization that preaches pure black on black love. Black man, love the black woman, take care of the black children, respect the black community, build up the black nation. Don't be an enemy to your own brother. Support and uplift all black economic efforts. Network with your people. Love one another. Resist the temptation to enter into conflict with one another. Nothing but pure black on black love, which has been interpreted as white hate. Big mistake. This program was filmed, and this would have been part of the inspiration for Louis Lomax to want to set the record straight. At the time of his death in 1970, Louis Lomax had a 141-page FBI file in his possession. And while Louis Lomax was in the midst of beginning to produce this Malcolm X movie on the truth of the assassination of Malcolm X and the involvement of the FBI since 52 years ago, Louis Lomax got into his car, was on the highway, and mysteriously there were no brakes. Louis Lomax died in a car accident. Years later, Spike Lee did a Malcolm X movie, which, for the most part, was a good movie, but was riddled with inaccuracies and inconsistencies, and it did not tell some of the most important parts of the story, especially regarding the assassination of Malcolm X. And there were three key characters in Malcolm X's life that were not even mentioned or shown or seen in the movie. One was Imam Warith Deen Muhammad, the son of the Honorable Elijah Muhammad, who Malcolm X was a colleague with. He actually asked Imam Warith Deen Muhammad to be the leader of Muslim Mosque Incorporated while Malcolm X took the leadership of the OAAU. Second, Minister Louis Farrakhan, who was the closest confidant of Malcolm X when they were both ministers in the Nation of Islam. And third, Muhammad Ali. Muhammad Ali gave Malcolm X's whole family a holiday. They were very close, brothers to the end. But when Malcolm X uttered one word against the Honorable Elijah Muhammad, Muhammad Ali cut him off completely. And Muhammad Ali's life is also a testimony to many of these FBI files that have been made available here. Because the FBI and the American government were looking at how the Honorable Elijah Muhammad was telling black men, don't fight in the white man's war. Said, we were kidnapped, brought over here from Africa, beaten, robbed, raped, killed, mass murdered, and enslaved. And now you're going to fight for the people who did that to you against people who never did anything against you. And the Honorable Elijah Muhammad said, don't fight in their wars. And Muhammad Ali, as heavyweight boxing champion of the world, his name was Cassius Clay. Then the Honorable Elijah Muhammad gave him the name Muhammad Ali. And he announced to the world, I am now a Muslim, I'm a member of the Nation of Islam, and I'm a student of the Honorable Elijah Muhammad. And when he refused to go to war for the white man, in 1967, they took away his title. And there was an extensive set of meetings with the Supreme Court judges trying to put Muhammad Ali in jail. But in 1970, he got back his license to fight through various legal loopholes. And of course, he went back on to win the title two or three times again. But the sensationalism around the life of Malcolm X has been really ridiculous. So now there's a new movie called One Night in Miami with Malcolm X being portrayed, Jim Brown, Sam Cooke, and one other character, Muhammad Ali. And then there's this Godfather of Harlem series, again portraying Malcolm X. And they're showing him talking to the Honorable Elijah Muhammad as if both of them were like peers in some old small room somewhere. It's just pure, total misrepresentation. But this is how the enemy works. Today was a fantastic day because at the Kwame Ture Center, we hosted two batches of students who came in for the African History Month displays. And I was able to do two audiovisual presentations with them. Young people, again, inspired. First time they're hearing some things about great black inventions, contributions of African people to civilization and humanity, great black business successes. And we also told them about Kwame Ture, the man who we named the building after. And we said, Kwame Ture, born in Trinidad, formerly known as Stokely Carmichael, that the FBI established a special dirty tactic against Kwame Ture, which they called bad jacketing, where they fabricated Kwame Ture's handwriting, wrote letters to the Black Panthers, Huey P. Newton, Bobby Seale, and Eldridge Cleaver, created division and disunity between them, and then Kwame Ture ended up leaving America, going to Africa, taking the first name of Kwame Nkrumah of Ghana and the surname of Sekou Touré of Guinea, and taking on the name Kwame Ture and starting the All African People's Revolutionary Party. So, our strength is in our unity. And let me close just making a point about Kyle Rittenhouse, because you'd have seen that verdict. Now, listen, I have done two videos within the last 6 months that have gotten such a violent reaction from white people in America. The first one I did back in August. It's on the Black Agenda Project page. It's also on my David Muhammad page. It was entitled, To Those Who Say That Africans Sold Africans Into Slavery. The video is just passing 250,000 views, a quarter of a million views. And many of our people in Africa connected with it, and they appreciate the perspective. But a lot of white people in places like Texas and Alabama and Mississippi has somehow got linked with this video and expressed their anger that a black man in the Caribbean, in Trinidad, would suggest that the Africans who were involved in slavery were doing so on behalf of the white people, and the white people would have manipulated us into being at each other's throats, and that there were more Africans who fought against enslavement on the African continent than there were Africans who participated in it. Some of the white people got so angry with that perspective for whatever reason. But the second reaction that I got is with this video that I did just a few days ago, after the verdict of Kyle Rittenhouse. And here I pointed out that this white teenager was at home looking at TV. He's seeing a Black Lives Matter protest on TV. Then he's inspired to leave his home, get a gun, AR-15 semi-automatic assault rifle, go to the protest. Whatever happened, whatever reason, whatever, he killed two people, shot a third, shot at others and missed. He ended up getting back home without being arrested. He later turned himself in. My position was that if this was a black man who killed two people in public with a weapon and shot a third and shot at others, he would not have survived to even leave that street. They would have mowed him down. And this is why in 2016, in that FBI building that was taken over by the white militia, some so-called patriots, they had guns, took over a federal building and held a press conference on the steps of it. making some demands for some issue with their farms or whatever it was. But they had their guns in a press conference, took over a building, and the police stood by looking at them. And I'm saying that if it's a black man, that they would have killed him. Okay, that's my opinion. But hundreds of white people, and God alone knows how they got onto my Black Agenda Project Facebook page. And one after the other, after the other, after the other, saying, you don't know what you're talking about. Kyle Rittenhouse was a hero. He was defending, and this is the key phrase that is used, the code word, America. He was defending America. Someone even called him the new Captain America. Now, even President Joe Biden condemned the verdict. All kinds of politicians across the United States condemned the verdict. But there's still a whole cadre of people who are saying that man was a hero. That they need more like him. Now, incidentally, the people that he killed in the Black Lives Matter protest were white people. Many people said, don't use the word protest. It was a riot. I'm talking white people vexed with your brother. But one of the key points, and I want you to think about this. One of the key points that they were making was that the two people that he killed had criminal records. And that was the justification for them. That a man could be looking at TV, feel infuriated by what he saw, leave his house, get a gun, go to the scene, end up killing people, and then go back home. And the justification for him killing those people was that they had a criminal record. Now, when they look at us, they see all of us as criminals. Hence the justification. I want you to think, beloved, think. And as I've always said, three things that do not work for black people: guns, drugs, and politics. First of all, with guns. Guns were invented by white people to kill black people. So even when a black man has a gun in his hand, he's not going to kill or shoot anyone else but another black man like himself. Because the possession of the gun is merged and combined with the indoctrination of self-hatred through white supremacy that came through a colonial agenda to miseducate us and a media representation of us as savages. So you put guns in the black community, the only other people that black people with guns are going to kill are black people like us. And if there was any risk whatsoever of whites or Syrians or Chinese being shot with guns that black people possess, it would not be so easy for us to get guns in the first place. Second, drugs. In all the visits that I've made into the prisons, I've never seen any white people in prison for drugs or Chinese people. Or Indian people or Syrians. But according to Dr. Darius Figuera, there are no African drug lords on the top level. He said all of the drug lords, the major importers and traffickers of illegal narcotics in Trinidad, are whites, Chinese, Syrians, and Indians. But African people are 95% in the prison. And when the white people and the Syrians and the Chinese traffic drugs, they buy houses, property, land, real estate, send their children to university, buy cars and trucks, businesses, and expand their entrepreneurship. When we sell drugs, apart from going to jail or getting shot and killed in some ignorant gang conflict, what do we do with the money that we make from the drugs? Spinning rims, paint job on a car, gold chains. Oh man, if that's how you're thinking, that those gold chains are representing chains of slavery that have been taken off our hands and feet and put on our minds but falling down to our necks. And third, politics. Okay, I respect everyone's political choices. But you have all these different political parties, but when it comes to the backbiting and the quarreling and arguing and squabbling, it's African people in one party against African people in another party. And regardless of which party's in power, it's the same. Whites and Chinese and Syrians and French Creoles that are getting rich. All of the contracts. We just wear the t-shirts, the hat, wave the flag, run behind the truck and get nothing. And then they try to impress upon your mind that you're worth nothing, you deserve nothing. And the only way you can benefit from being part of our political organization is if you involve yourself in the pulling down of your own people. So as Jomo Kenyatta said, when the white man came to Africa, he had the Bible, we had the land. He taught us to pray with our eyes closed. When we open back up our eyes, he had the land, we had the Bible. So we say that when the politician comes into the community, he has the politics, we have the power. He teaches us to think with our minds closed. When we open back up our minds, we have the politics and he has the power. The politics is the paraphernalia. The colors and the flags and the banners and the t-shirts and the posters. But he has the power. And he takes the power, which is the voting numbers combined, takes that power, gives it to his finances, and leaves the masses of the people in poverty. So guns, drugs, and politics, The negative impact of those within our communities have to be replaced by unity, self-sufficiency, business entrepreneurship, land ownership, and reorganization of our families. Think, black people. And I say to us, let us unite. We have resumed our Sunday lectures at the Kwame Ture Center. So the weekly Nation of Islam lecture series every Sunday morning at 11 o'clock at the Kwame Ture Center. And this Saturday, beloved, all day at the Kwame Ture Center, we're having African Expo number 10. Come out and support. The amount of people who see you on the street and send messages via social media, tell, oh, that's such a great thing that you're doing, uniting black businesses, creating a network. You have the Black Business Directory. All right, but have you supported? That's how you can make a difference. So we urge you to come out and support. We're getting the young people, the students involved in the economic initiatives of the Black Agenda Project organization. Give the young people that encouragement. And all of the information, again, is in this great book, Black Studies. And we have a full 14 pages plus on the assassination of Malcolm X. All of the FBI files, the CIA files, the releasing of content due to the Freedom of Information Act. It's all in there, Black Studies. And that's just one chapter. There's so much more. So go to the website, www.blackagendaproject.com. You can either order the hard copies of the books we ship out every Monday, or you can download the PDF files of Black Studies, of Knowledge is Power, and also my new book, my PhD thesis, Black Youth at Risk from Juvenile Delinquency to Criminal Gang Activity, which contains extensive quantitative and qualitative research on the conditions of our black youth as it pertains to broken homes, dysfunctional families, faulty parenting, gang membership, the drug trade, unemployment, educational underachievement, and the psychological damage done to the minds of black children in a post-colonial educational system. www.blackagendaproject.com. Please continue to share this video with our people. Please continue to circulate the information. Thank you once again to the 20,000 plus followers of the Black Agenda Project organization on Facebook. But the work continues. And as I said, today was a great day with all the students coming in and all these 14-year-olds, 15-year-olds, 16-year-olds, 17-year-olds. And then we had the social studies class after that this evening. Again, young people between the ages of 18 and 25. Getting all this black knowledge, who weren't even born as yet when we were halfway through the mission just 20 or 30 years ago. It's inspiring, beloved. But let's all do our part. I'm grateful to my leader and teacher, the Honorable Minister Louis Farrakhan, for showing me that attention when I was 22 years old and bringing me up to St. Kitts back in 1993 for the 40th anniversary of his wedding. And for me to be there as a total stranger from Trinidad, 22 years old, the inspiration that I got from that man. I could never pay him back for what he did for me. But what I can do is pay it forward to the youth who are 22 now that I've just hit 50. So, beloved, thank you so much for being in our viewing and listening audience once again. Remember, I'm on 91.9 FM, Saturday morning, 7 to 9. I'm on Gael TV every Sunday evening, 8 o'clock live. And then I am, once again, repeated, Gael TV, 8 p.m. on Tuesdays, 9 a.m. on Wednesdays. Go to the website. Thank you so much. We also have our own online radio station running 24/7. Let me say goodnight to the people in Philadelphia as well. May Almighty God Allah continue to bless you as I greet you in peace. Assalamu alaikum.